In the army now, but not quite. In the army now, but not quite. In 2005, a year after our wedding, I took Diane and the family to Cyprus. It was her first time there, and we stayed at the Acapulco Hotel in Gerna, Carinia. The place worked its magic instantly. Diane fell in love with the island, the people, the food, the sun, and especially the poolside serenity. That trip would become the beginning of an annual pilgrimage for us. By 2007, we returned with Caitlin, Josh, and Theo in tow. Ben and Remy, no doubt drawn by the temptations of house parties and teenage freedom, stayed behind. We booked Josh and Theo their own room next to ours. The thrill of independence hit them like a Cypriot cocktail. Late-night skinny dips, dashes from hotel security, and a bustling new circle of holiday mates quickly became the norm. Checkout was less joyful. I nearly fell over when I saw the bar bill. £1,000. They weren't even legally allowed to drink, but they'd cleverly charged everything to our room. Furious but cornered, I paid it and gave them both a scolding they'd never forget, or so I thought. The next year, we left Caitlin and Ben to run the cafe and returned with just Josh and Theo. I made my expectations clear. If you're drinking, you're paying. They nodded, serious-faced, promising no more surprises. That week, Diane parked herself by the pool, headphones on, Coke in one hand, cigarette in the other, glowing like a Mediterranean queen. I joined the boys in pool games and table tennis, but halfway through the week, the boys started sulking. It doesn't feel like a family holiday without Caitlin, Ben, and Remy, they muttered. I had to admit, I agreed. Checking the UK weather, grim obviously, I found EasyJet flights to Larnaca and contacted the hotel. Yes, they had availability. Without telling the boys, I rang Caitlin, Ben, and Remy. Shut the cafe. You're coming to Cyprus. When they arrived, Josh and Theo were ecstatic, absolutely over the moon. The excitement radiating off them was infectious, the kind only a long-anticipated holiday could bring. But the joy didn't last uninterrupted. Not long after settling in, a German-Turkish tourist took note of our extended family. Eyeing the five kids, he asked, with a hint of condescension, how I managed to afford a trip like this. Before I could respond, he smirked and answered his own question. You're from England. Your government gives you lots of benefits. That's why. His words struck me like a slap. I snapped back, my temper flaring. I've never claimed a penny in benefits. Don't even know what I'd be entitled to. How would you know what I get when you're not even from England? I was seething. Is that what Britain's become? A country so globally typecast for its welfare system that foreigners confidently lecture us about it? Do they see our government as a cash machine with no code? Is that why we're seeing this relentless influx, because abroad, Britain is seen as a land of handouts? The second week was a blur for them. Up all night, asleep all day. And then, checkout. Another bar bill. This time from Ben and Remy, blissfully unaware of the you drink, you pay rule. I should have seen it coming. Da! In 2009, we returned again. Josh, Caitlin, and Theo came, along with Theo's girlfriend, Charlie. We landed in Larnaca and headed for the north, crossing the border into the Turkish-controlled side. But at the checkpoint, I was pulled aside. Sir, you need exit papers from the military consulate in Nicosia. I blinked. What for? You haven't completed your military service. Until you do, you can't leave Cyprus. Apparently, back in 1984, I'd signed a form during a visit stating I would return the following year to do my service. Obviously, I didn't. They'd sent letters, but they went to an old address. Now I was officially marked AWOL. You're 50 now, the officer said sternly. I'm 49, I replied. Here, you're 50. Your birthday is registered from the day you're born. What? Worse, since I was classed as AWOL, I could no longer buy my way out like others had done. I had to do the full 18 months, unless I failed the physical. But to even qualify for an exemption, I needed a Turkish ID, which could take up to 3 months to process. Nightmare. Enter Cousin Mehmet, my dad's nephew, who lived in the village of Ozenköy. As luck would have it, he'd once been a government chauffeur and bodyguard for the deputy prime minister. He made a few calls, pulled a few strings, and suddenly I was issued a Turkish ID, on one condition. I had to choose a name for it. I remembered that although Diane and I were married, she'd kept her ex-partner's surname, Nichols, so it matched the kids. So I asked, can I use Nichols? No problem, they said. And just like that, I became Ace and Nickel. Theo and Charlie were only staying a week. I promised Diane I'd make sure Theo and Charlie got through the border without any issues and made it to Larnaca in time for their flight. At the checkpoint, the guard refused to let me cross with them. "What if I run for it?" I joked. "We will shoot you," he replied. I wasn't laughing anymore. I had a quiet word with the cab driver, asking him to personally make sure Theo and Charlie got to Larnaca on time. With that, I turned back toward the hotel, resigned to the reality of a week of military assessments ahead in Gurnee. Diane and my friends found the whole thing hysterical. I started receiving messages with status quos, "You're in the Army now," as my ringtone. Martin texted, "How's your swimming? I'll bring my boat. We'll anchor offshore, and you can swim out. We'll smuggle you home." Diane gave me more practical advice. "Before your physical, down 6 sugar sachets. It'll spike your blood sugar. They'll think you've got diabetes." So I did exactly that. There I stood, in line with a row of 18-year-olds, in shorts and flip-flops, sweating like John Candy in a boot camp comedy. "I have sciatica," I told the doctor. "The Army will fix that." "I'm overweight." "The Army will fix that too." They did the tests and said the results would be sent to Ankara, with a turnaround of about 3 weeks. Our holiday soon came to an end, and Diane, Josh, and Caitlin had to fly back to London. I couldn't. I had to stay behind and move in with Mehmet. 3 weeks later, at the military hospital, they called my name, Ice and Nickel. I didn't answer immediately. It still didn't feel like me. But the result was in. I'd failed the physical, gloriously, and was finally handed my exit papers, granting me the freedom to come and go for the next 12 months. I swore I'd never go back. Freedom at last. 8 weeks later, I returned to Cyprus, this time with Martin and Fred, both buzzing with the kind of energy only first-timers bring. We were staying in a townhouse in Ozonkoi, just outside Girne, Kyrenia, where the cicadas hummed like background music and time seemed to move at half speed. One morning, we decided to visit St. Hilarion Castle. The road snaked steeply into the mountains, the sea glinting far below like a shattered pane of glass. As we climbed higher, the fortress came into view, jagged and magnificent, clinging to the rocks as if defying gravity itself. It looked like something conjured from legend, not architecture. A place that belonged in dreams or epic poems, not real life. Fred and Martin were ahead of me, practically skipping up the trail like mountain goats, laughing and calling back jokes. Me, I was struggling. Every step burned. My knees were on fire. My breath came in short, ragged gasps, and my shirt clung to me like wet cling film. I cursed every extra pound I'd carried up that damn slope. My legs felt like lead, and I kept stopping under the pretense of taking in the view, though in truth, I just needed to breathe. The incline was relentless, and I wasn't built for this kind of terrain. "Who the hell put a castle there?" Fred called back, panting as we neared the summit. "Someone who didn't want visitors," I wheezed, half-joking, but mostly just trying to survive the last few meters. Finally, we reached the top. I bent forward, hands on my knees, sweat pouring down my face. But the view, God, the view, made it worth every ache. The ruins loomed above us, ancient and surreal. Towers pierced the sky and weathered archways framed the vast Mediterranean far below. The stones were silent now, but they had stories etched deep into them. "According to the guidebooks," I said, my voice still catching in my throat, "St. Hilarion started as a monastery during the Byzantine era. Later, it was fortified to keep out Arab raiders." The history poured out of me as I caught my breath, touching the cool stone of the outer wall. "This is where Richard the Lionheart landed in 1191. Took Cyprus from a Byzantine rebel, Isaac Komnenos, on his way to the Holy Land." Fred raised an eyebrow. "Wasn't it the Ottomans back then?" "No," I shook my head. "The Ottomans came later. Richard captured the island, married off his sister here, then sold the whole place to the Knights Templar. One more move in the Game of Thrones during the Crusades." Martin leaned against a broken parapet. "Did he take Jerusalem in the end?" "Not really. He fought hard, spilled plenty of blood, but Jerusalem stayed out of reach. The whole thing was betrayal, bluster, and a lot of dead men in the sand." I gestured toward the upper tower, its silhouette like something out of a fairy tale. "They say Walt Disney based Sleeping Beauty's castle on this. You can see it, right?" Fred stared up, the sun catching the rough edges of the stone. "Yeah, I can." The wind picked up, brushing against my skin like a memory. I stood there, still aching from the climb, but strangely weightless in that moment. Below us lay Kyrenia, small and timeless, and beyond that, the glittering sea stretched to the horizon. It was easy to imagine the clang of swords, the low murmur of monks at prayer, the thunder of horses crossing stone. Time blurred, folded inward. For just a moment, I wasn't a tourist gasping for breath. I was part of it all. The castle, the mountain, the legend. We also made our way to Bellapice Abbey, a hauntingly beautiful ruin perched high above Kyrenia. Its Gothic arches stood solemn and skeletal against the blazing Mediterranean sky, casting long, spindly shadows over the ancient cloisters. The air was thick with memory. The stone beneath our feet was worn smooth by centuries of monastic footsteps, foreign invaders and pilgrims whose prayers had long since dissolved into the hot Cypriot wind. Just below the abbey lay the village of Bellapice, whitewashed and hushed, sun-baked and timeless. This was where Lawrence Durrell had lived during the turbulent 1950s while writing Bitter Lemons of Cyprus. He arrived as an outsider but left tangled in the island's complexities, its hospitality, its politics, and its inevitable heartbreak. His book isn't just a memoir. It's a quiet, lyrical eulogy to a Cyprus on the cusp of violence, a place already slipping into partition. Durrell wrote with the soul of a poet and the weary eye of a witness. We wandered the narrow lanes until we found his old house, plain, shuttered, wrapped in the unruly embrace of bougainvillea, perched just where the mountain begins to fall away into valley. A brass plaque marked its quiet significance. Then we found it, the Tree of Idleness. In truth, it wasn't just one tree, but two. An intertwined pair of a fig and a mulberry, their trunks fused together over time as if nature itself conspired to birth a myth. Under their tangled canopy, the light scattered in soft patches. According to village lore, and repeated fondly by Durrell, nothing of importance ever happened beneath those branches. Time stood still. Men forgot errands. Women forgot quarrels. Even ambition, it seemed, was lulled to sleep under that shade. We sat there playing backgammon like the villagers before us, letting the hours slide past unnoticed. There was laughter and silence and something else, a stillness that felt earned. Idle by choice, idle by design. The following morning, the three of us set out into the heart of Old Town Gurn, where time itself seemed to linger in the worn cobblestones and narrow winding streets. At the edge of the sapphire sea rose the ancient castle, its weathered walls whispering stories of forgotten battles and long-vanished kings. Beyond it stretched the marina, alive with the clatter of rigging and the fragrance of salt and tar, its scattered cafes and moored boats painting a scene that felt both eternal and fleeting, as though we had stepped into a living tapestry of history and seaborne dreams. Amongst the steep stone steps, shaded by weather-beaten awnings, we paused at a little cafe whose tables seemed to spill haphazardly into the street. The scent of grilled fish and lemon drifted through the air, luring us in. The patron, a wiry old fisherman with skin tanned like cured leather, proudly announced that today's catch had been hauled in by his own hand from one of the very boats rocking gently in the harbor below. We ordered without hesitation, feeling the salt of the sea still clinging to each morsel. Our waitress was a middle-aged Eastern European woman with sharp cheekbones, tired eyes, and a frankness that startled and amused in equal measure. Between balancing plates and pouring wine, she confided, half in jest, half in earnest, that what she truly longed for was a Western husband to rescue her from her current lot in life. "A good man," she said with a sigh, "to take me away and make me a wife." Fred and I exchanged a wicked glance, and in a burst of mischief we thrust poor Martin forward as the perfect candidate. He was, after all, a retired bachelor, still single, still searching, and surely in need of both adventure and companionship. "There you go," we laughed, "a match made in heaven. He'll marry you, make an honest woman of you, and take you back to England." Martin, red-faced but chuckling, tried to wave us off, though the woman, with a wry smile and a glint of hope, or perhaps calculation in her eyes, seemed to entertain the idea more seriously than he ever expected. For a moment, amid the clinking of glasses and the cries of gulls overhead, it felt as though we were less in a cafe and more in some farcical play, cast suddenly in roles we hadn't rehearsed. I promised myself then, just one more visit. I needed to fail that physical again. So I returned the following year in August, alone this time. Same military hospital, same scuffed floors, same sun-bleached plastic chairs in the waiting room. I wore the same loose shorts, the same flip-flops slapping against tile like distant echoes of resignation. Only this time, I carried more weight. Deliberate, planned, weaponized. I had become my own protest. Just like before, I emptied the sugar sachets into my mouth, each one gritty and sickening. My stomach turned, but my resolve held. But it didn't matter. When they called me in, the doctor barely glanced at me. No tests, no blood, no ceremony. Just a look, a sigh, and a stamp. Unfit for service. Twice declared unfit. Honorably discharged, without lifting a finger, without donning a uniform, without so much as a salute. And I'd never felt prouder. But Cyprus, ever unpredictable, had one last twist waiting for me. At the border checkpoint, an officer flagged me down. He handed me a sheaf of papers, traffic fines, a whole collection, speeding, illegal parking, unpaid tolls, all dated from that road trip with Martin and Fred. I blinked. It wasn't me, I said with perfect sincerity. Fred drove the whole time. The guard studied my face for a moment. Then he gave a faint, amused nod and waved me through. Of course they believed me. After all, who wouldn't believe Ace and Nickel, of all people, could tear around Cyprus in a car and escape military service? So that was my odyssey. A bar-bill disaster turned military conscription saga, complete with assumed identities, exit visas, sugar highs, historical detours, and a healthy dose of humor. I may now be Ice and Nickel on official records in northern Cyprus, but back in the UK I remain proudly and properly myself. Free to travel, two-time certified unfit for national service, and a veteran of every kind of absurdity Cyprus could throw at me.